As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, just a quick update from me, Caldoni, here. We're going to do this one in two parts. So it's going to look like a really short episode, but never fear, we are going to upload the rest of it as soon as possible. And in fact, actually probably later tonight. So we're going to get the general setup for the story in the first part, and then we're going to talk about our theories on the story in the second part.
Oh, I see the red dot.
Yeah, we're rolling.
You ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Oh, you're ready. You've been ready all weekend.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni. This is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I am Joe, joined, as always, by
Vincent Caldoni.
Yeah, we've got another shocking story for you this week. We're going to tell you about the first time a nuclear reactor blew up. So,
That sounds cool.
This was from the pioneering days of nuclear power. So, really, you don't need to worry. Don't need to get anxious about that power plant down your street. You know, it's okay. You know, then people screw up and all that stuff. But in this case, it might have been more than just a screw up.
Yeah, I think that's where things get interesting.
Well, yeah, there's some longstanding rumors in this case that the accident was actually not an accident at all, that it may have been sabotage.
Or a murder plot.
Possibly even that, yeah. Was it? Well, as always, there are conflicting stories, and the evidence can be interpreted more than one way. But that's, of course, why you employ us here at the Shocking Details HQ. To read all those reports and the evidence and sort it all out for you and tell you what to think. Yeah, that's what we're good at.
That's what we do.
Absolutely.
All right, well, first let's skip to the end. The incident took place on January 3rd, 1961. Three men were killed in the accident. But why did it happen? There was, of course, a major inquiry into this, physical evidence being established conclusively that the reactor incident was caused by someone pulling the central control rod out of the reactor core.
We'll explain all that, what control rods are, for those of you who maybe are.
Yeah, we're going to get into it. But
long story short, somebody did pull that control rod, correct?
Yes. Whoever did it, they would have known that this was a really bad idea.
Yeah.
These guys worked there. So if I know that, they definitely understood that that would be a big problem.
Oh, yeah.
Rumors have been flying all about the nuclear community for decades. And the prevalent theory is that it was done as some sort of act of murder-suicide.
Yeah. Yeah, if you read about this online, it appears in a few places hither and yon. And yeah, it's generally considered to be that an act of despair, a spite, et cetera.
What a way to go, man.
Yeah, it is a quick way to do it if you want to kill yourself. I mean, pulling that control rod out, bam, it's over. Like, whoever pulled that rod out was dead less than a second afterwards.
That's true.
Well, first off, let's talk about the reactor itself. This was a new prototype called the SL-1. The S stands for small, and the L stands for low output. So, there you go, SL-1. The new design was a response to a request from the U.S. Army for a small, kind of sort of portable reactor that could be used to power bases up in the subarctic. The Army was operating a string of bases in northern Alaska, Canada, Greenland, that was called the Dew Line.
D-E-W. Oh, I know about this one.
I know. Dew is an acronym for Distant Early Warning. These were radar stations way up in the north, which were supposed to detect waves of Soviet bombers heading over the North Pole to nuke the United States. Mm-hmm. Remember, this was like in the late 50s, early 60s, early days of the Cold War and the nuclear standoff. So there really was a lot of worry about those bombers and, you know, and later ballistic missiles coming over the pole. But so there was this whole Dew Line up there, and these outposts were powered by diesel generators. And of course, they required regular shipments of fuel, and it was flown in because most of them were in places where there really weren't any roads. And if there were roads, well, they'd be snowed in. So, but just flying all this fuel in all the time was a pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of work. And so if every base had its own nuclear power plant, that would have been just way cool, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could have all kinds of applications for a portable nuclear reactor.
Yeah, not just for the Dew Line, but for other things too. And so this small reactor concept was born.
So the reactor building itself was cylindrical. It sort of looked like a squat farm silo. It was about 48 feet high and 38 feet in diameter. So not something you're going to stuff into an airplane, but it could be brought in pieces and quickly assembled. Inside of it, there were three levels. The bottom held the reactor vessel, which is like this tall cylinder encased in rock and gravel. The second held the control room and the turbine, and the upper level held the condenser system. So it's really just all the things you'd expect to see in a nuclear power plant, but real small.
Yeah, real compact little arrangement.
The SL-1 was a water boiling reactor. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit different from the typical system you're probably familiar with, which is the pressurized water reactor. In a PWR, that's the pressurized water reactor.
Yeah.
The primary cooling loop is pressurized so that the water inside it superheats way beyond boiling temperature, but never turns to steam because it can't escape.
Yeah.
It's condensed, pressurized, if you will. Yeah. It goes through a heat exchanger, which heats the water in the secondary loop, which does turn to steam. And that high pressure steam turns turbines and that creates electricity. The steam is cooled, condensed back into water and returned to the system.
Yeah. So that's your PWR. But a boiling water reactor, on the other hand, saves bulk and weight by eliminating the secondary loop and the heat exchanger. So the water is turned into steam within the reactor vessel itself. So in the SL-1, the steam went to the second level to spin the turbine. Then it went up from there to the third floor for a condensing and eventual return back to the reactor vessel. There you go. It's a nice, simple little concept. And
it does sound simple.
It appeared to work until it didn't. But I think the concept is actually fundamentally a reasonable enough concept. But I can sense a disturbance in the force. A million voices crying out, how does it all work? You know, where does all this heat come from? Right.
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Well, I'm sure almost all of our listeners understand how nuclear fission works. Right? But for the tiny percentage you don't quite understand how it works, it's like this. You put a bunch of highly enriched uranium, you arrange it into fuel rods, fuel assemblies, and you put them together and assemble them into the core where they're all kind of close together. And because they're so close together and because they're essentially casting off neutrons all the time, then you put them next to each other, they can go critical. Because they're shooting little neutrons into one another, and those neutrons are hitting atoms. Those atoms are splitting, releasing tons of energy, but also sending off other neutrons, which in turn split more atoms, releasing still more energy. And it's a thing that, like, every time you split an atom, you release a bunch of these neutrons, which would split a bunch more atoms. So it's an exponential process.
Right. Chain reaction.
Yeah, it is a chain reaction, and it grows really, really rapidly. I'll share some numbers with you here about this particular incident, and you'll find them a little mind gobbling. Anyway, the way the whole thing is controlled is use control rods. And what these are is they're not really rods, but the part that sticks out of the reactor on the top generally is a rod. But then it connects up to something that's more akin to like a paddle or a blade. And quite often they're cruciform shaped. So looking at them from the top, they're actually kind of like, imagine two really wide sword blades that were welded together in a cross shape when you looked at them like kind of lengthwise. And then that long sort of cross-shaped blade slides down in between all those fuel elements. It's usually made of something like, in this case, in this reactor, it was cadmium, something that absorbs and blocks neutrons and therefore inhibits the fission process.
Right.
So that's how you keep it under control, is those control rods.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our reactor, the SL1, had 9 control rods. But on the day of the incident, January 3rd, 1961, only 5 of those control rods were in place. Although this wasn't as problematic as you might think, because actually there's of the 60 fuel assemblies that could have been in the fuel core, 20 of them were not there. So there were only 40 of them. So they didn't really need all 9 control rods.
Right.
But they did have 5 there in place. And by the way,
we're clear, where are we at right now when this is happening?
Oh, yeah. Physically speaking, yeah, we are in Idaho. Yeah. It's the Idaho National Laboratories, which, by the way, you know, you can't really find it on Google Maps. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't. If you type that in, what you'll get is you get some buildings. The facility where they actually do the fun stuff with the reactors and stuff is about 40 miles west of Idaho Falls, Idaho.
Okay.
Out in the prairie or high desert or whatever you want to call it out there.
Yeah.
But there's also a bunch of buildings in Idaho Falls itself. So if you type in Idaho National Laboratories, you'll get those buildings in Idaho Falls. So if you want to find the secret facility out in the desert, go to Google Maps, type in EBR2 space Idaho.
And, okay.
And EBR stands for Experimental Breeder Reactor 2. So that is actually labeled in Google Maps, even though the facility itself is a complete blank. It's not labeled at all, but for some reason somebody put a tag on EBR2, so you can find that. Anyway, you'll see it. It's out there. And then our particular reactor was set up about 10 miles east of there. So between Idaho Falls and the secret facility, about 10 miles east of there, about a half a mile north of Highway 20 is where it was.
Yeah, that's.
I looked on the aerials and stuff. I couldn't find a trace of it there.
Okay.
Because, of course, it's been removed since then.
The SL1 had been down since just before Christmas, and it was scheduled to resume operation on January 4th. So on January 3rd, the day shift installed 44 new cobalt flux wires in the reactor, inside of the core of the reactor.
Yeah, apparently those wires enabled them to monitor neutron activity in the core.
Oh, that makes sense.
Apparently, it's kind of important. You want to know what your neutrons are up to in there.
Yeah, I think that would be something you'd want to know about.
Yeah, the more of them that are flying around, you know, the more fission you get. And so you want to, and of course, you want to keep that process under control. Right, exactly.
You need to be very aware of that. This required them to disconnect the control rods from their drive mechanisms, which were in the way.
Yeah.
So the 4 p.m. to midnight shift had the job of reconnecting the control rods to the drive itself.
And by the way, the access to the top of the reactor was just right there in the second floor of the building. It was right in the middle of the second floor. It was set just right in the floor of the control room area is where the top of the reactor was. That's where these guys were doing their work. So the night shift was the 4 p.m. to midnight shift was 3 men. The shift supervisor was a Navy CB, Richard C. Legg. By the way, the guys staffing this were military. They were, because it was intended that these facilities were going to be operated by Army, Navy, Air Force people. Mm-hmm. And therefore they recruited their best and their brightest to come in and train on these reactors and learn how to operate them and maintain them. So that's what these guys were doing, and there were other, you know, many other crews also working on this thing. So anyway, back to our staff here, the supervisor, Navy CB Richard C. Legg. And 2 Army guys, Richard L.
He's a Navy man named C. Legg.
I know. I love it. Yeah. And then what do we got here? There were 2 Army.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed, when I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hey guys, Richard L. McKinley, he was new to the job. He was a trainee. And John A. Burns, who was not a trainee, but he was still a young guy. He was 22 years old. And I'll say right now, a lot of suspicion has fallen on John Burns in this story. But, you know, we're going to talk about that in a little more detail here later.
So if Burns was the bad guy, then why?
Good question.
Well, reportedly, he and Legg didn't get along so well, him and C-Legs. On top of that, Legg had just been promoted to shift supervisor, and that meant that he was now Burns' boss.
That's got to burn.
No
pun intended.
Was intended. Also, Burns was having marital troubles. Things were really kind of circling the drain at home. And according to the report of the inquiry, his wife, Arlene, had phoned him at work at 7 p.m. to ask for a divorce.
Yeah, that's cold. That's a classy move, huh?
Yeesh, right, yeah.
Don't you think? Right. Yeah, well, no, they've been kind of off work for a couple of weeks for the Christmas break. They closed the reactor down 2 days before Christmas, and we're going to restart it the day after this. So apparently, yeah, they're home, you know, for an extended, like, kind of mini vacation around the Christmas time. And she just sits around the entire time and waits till his first day back at work after the Christmas break, and then calls him at work and tells him. I mean, really?
I don't know. That sounds cold, man.
A little bit. But there was, as you just referred, there was a post-accident inquiry, which took many months, almost 2 years, actually. And by the time the final report was released, rumors had been flying about for quite a long time. And the report itself was careful to not explicitly endorse these rumors, but it didn't rule them out either. Yeah, right.
So at 9 p.m., the crew commenced the task of reconnecting the control rods to the drive mechanisms. This required them to pull each rod upward an inch or two. At the top of each rod was a ball machined into the metal. A gripper from the drive mechanism latched onto this ball. You sort of like almost like a, so I pictured almost like a trailer hitch or whatever.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah.
It kind of seems like it. Then a C-clamp was removed from the rod. It was, of course, very important to only raise the rod a few inches. Much further than that, and a whole lot of fission would start happening. And trust me, that was not what anybody wanted.
Especially those guys, right?
Yeah, really, those guys were the last ones. Yeah.
Yeah, there was one possibility that was put forth by the report, which is that the central control rod was sticking, which had happened in the past, by the way. And if this had happened, then perhaps our guys were pulling on it harder than they should have. And when it finally, suddenly, unexpectedly broke free, they pulled the rod accidentally up higher than it should have gone. And that was that.
I could see that. Yeah. I could see that happening. That is not crazy.
Yeah, and it would have been super quick. No time to react or anything. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me do a finger snap. Ready? So some calculations were made, and it was concluded that for that particular uranium fuel configuration, and also considering the age of the fuel elements, because again, they go downward in their in their spiciness as time goes by. But for the size, the arrangement, the age, they calculated a 4-millisecond neutron doubling period. So that means if you start with just one neutron flying around within 1/10 of a second, according to my calculator anyway, you will have 33,555,000 neutrons flying around splitting atoms. And then within 2/10 of a second, you'll have that number squared.
That's a lot.
That's how exponentially quick this process is. And so it's estimated that there was a period of maybe perhaps 1/3 of a second between pulling the rod and the big kerblooey. So there was not even enough time for these guys to say, oh, crap.
Oof.
Not even that.
Yeah.
Pull the rod and bam, lights out.
So as part of the maintenance process, some water had been drained from the reactor vessel. So there was a 2-foot gap between the water and the top of the reactor vessel. The fuel assembly was about 7 feet below the surface of the water. When the reactor suddenly went critical, the water around the fuel was immediately turned to steam. It just vaporized the whole tank.
Not the entire tank, just the water right around the fuel core.
So yeah, but that's a lot of steam being released.
And expanding.
Which is what you got to know about. The water above, that would have stayed water. And that plug of water would have been shot straight upward by the expanding steam beneath it, like a bullet out of a gun, right? Because of the shape of the reactor vessel. Mm-hmm. It hit the top of the reactor vessel, caused it to jump 9 feet upward.
Mm.
The guys on the second level, they didn't even know what hit them.
Yeah, they didn't. And actually, it came as a pleasant surprise, well, sort of, to the guys. They spent a lot of time wondering. They knew they had to remove the reactor vessel. And they were wondering, well, it's going to be radioactive as hell. We're going to have to send crews in there. It's like that movie Chernobyl that was on HBO.
That's what I imagine it being like.
To saw on all these connecting pipes and everything to free it so we can lift it out of there. And we're going to send them in there for just brief periods until they get a limit to their radiation dose, and then replace them with another and cycle them on like that. They had it all. They were working out all these things. And then suddenly they realized, as they looked at it more closely, they realized the whole thing had jumped 9 feet in the air and torn all the pipes loose anyhow. So it's like, oh, I guess we don't have to do that after all. But it wasn't so good for the guys that were inside that building. Burns and Leg were killed instantly. Leg was essentially nailed to the ceiling of the control room.
Oof, poor guy.
Remember when we said that 4 of the 9 control rods were not in place in the reactor? So the holes in the top of the reactor vessel for those 4 rods had been plugged. One of those plugs, actually, they all shot out, but one of them speared Leg and basically pinned him to the ceiling.
Oh my gosh.
Nasty way to go. And it took 6 days to recover his body.
Mm.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Richard McKinley, he survived initially. Which is actually pretty incredible. He had massive head injuries and died within a few hours without ever regaining consciousness. It's probably for the best that he died of his head injuries, because he received a massive dose of radiation and would have died a hideous and painful death from radiation poisoning a few days later anyhow. So he was doomed.
Mm-hmm. He was, poor guy.
So,
yeah.
Was a sticky control rod responsible for this horrible accident?
Yeah.
Not so fast. That's what the report said. It said it just like that. Not so fast. No, it didn't. It said that while there had been incidents of control rods sticking in the past, they had all happened while the reactor was operating, not when it was cool. So am I right to think that that's because when it's operating, it's going to be hot and expand a little bit?
Yeah.
But when it's cool, it's going to be easier to slide those things in and out.
Yeah.
Am I correct about that?
Yeah. I think that was the thinking there. Yeah. But as part of the investigation, they made a mock-up of the top of the reactor vessel. It had a movable control rod in it with 84 pounds of weight on it underneath, which is the same as the real control rods. They weighed 84 pounds. And then they had a volunteer, they ran this test with more than one guy. They had a volunteer grab the rod, pull upward, and they simulated the rod being stuck and then suddenly released it, which would simulate a rod suddenly coming unstuck. And they concluded from their experiments that only maybe 10 inches of over travel was likely. So the central control rod in our reactor had been pulled 20 inches out of its closed position. Now, when they started, it was already about 2 inches from being fully closed before anybody started pulling on it. So that meant somebody had pulled it upward 18 inches, which is about 8 inches beyond what the simulation said could have happened accidentally.
All right. So, but was the simulation really as good as reality? I mean,
Hard to say, right?
Right. Yeah, it's hard to say. The AEC, what does AEC stand
Atomic
for?
Atomic Energy Commission.
The Atomic Energy Commission. Yeah. They thought it was. They thought it was actually a pretty good simulation. I mean, you know, for whatever that's worth. So it concluded remarks in the report saying, this is a quote here, "We may never know why the rod was lifted too high." This is essentially some tacit acceptance of the rumors that John Burns had deliberately pulled the central control rod out of the fuel pile, causing the disaster. So he actually intentionally jammed it up in there.
Mm.
And that has been the story, the rumor ever since.
So, and the story has grown a little bit. I think I read one account of this. It said there might even have been a little love triangle going on between him and his wife and Legg, the supervisor.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah, so
the dirty dog.
That adds a little extra motive to the whole thing, you know, because you commit suicide and take out your wife's lover, you know, same time. Although again, that's one of those things where there's no evidence of that at all, but you know, things get grafted onto stories on the internet and stuff. So but yeah, I mean, essentially the story is, and this makes it a much juicier story when somebody actually, you know, does a sort of murder suicide kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, of course, our question here, the mystery here, is that really true? Did John Burns really actually commit suicide and murder two other people by deliberately pulling that control rod out on purpose? Did he?
Hard to say.
Yeah. Well, we have some theories for you. But first,
we have some theories.
First, a word from our sponsors. Our primary sponsor this week is Cobble, the movie. Starring Nicolas Cage, Alexander Schwarzenegger. No, actually, hang on. Okay, here we go. Snap. Starring Nicolas Cage, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, who play hapless Americans trapped in Kabul, captive of the Taliban. And they act like total weenies until Chuck Norris comes in and rescues them all and takes out the entire Taliban, too. So, Kabul, the movie, coming soon to theaters near you. Who's our other sponsor?
I just want to tell our listeners, this was just dropped on me. This is not in the script. We didn't talk about this, but I'm in here just like you guys being like, what is Joe?
You don't know about it? I'll get with the program, dude, because you're going to direct it. You know,
apparently I already have.
Well, no, it hasn't been made yet, but that's okay.
Oh, I see.
But,
you know, okay,
we'll start filming next week. I got to work on the script still, and I got to get Cage and Schwarzenegger and Willis on board, and not to mention.
Yeah, I think that'll be easy. I think, especially if you promise that you'll film it actually in Kabul. I just want to remind you guys, I won't go on too long about it, since we've had such a fun exchange about Kabul the movie.
You can cut that out if you feel like it too.
Whatever, we'll leave it. It's just some real trip to Joeville. My movie Contactee is still out there on Amazon. It is no longer on Prime, but you can rent it, you can watch it, you can even buy it if you want. So check it out, Contactee.
Hell yeah. All the cool kids are watching it. Don't be left behind.
Yeah, FOMO. Yeah. Okay, so that concludes part one. We're going to have part two out for you probably within the next 24 hours, so be watching for it. Thanks for hanging on.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.